Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It was a series of seemingly random stabbings that shocked the Davis community. Three people were attacked in the college town in less than a week. Two were killed, and a third is critically injured. The stabbings put the normally lively UC Davis community on edge. But that anxiety began to ease a little bit with an arrest last week. The suspect, a former UC Davis student, made his first court appearance in court on Friday. CAP Radio reporter Kate Wolf joins us with more on where the investigation stands now. Kate, good morning.
Good morning, Vicky.
So it has been roughly 10 days since the first stabbing was reported. Who are the victims and are they connected in any way?
Vicky, the first victim was David Breaux, who was attacked on April 27th. He was 50 years old and was found on the bench where he often spent time. He was really a community fixture known as Compassion Guy, because for years, first in Oakland and then in Davis, he would have conversations with people about what compassion meant to them. 2 days later, 20-year-old UC Davis student Kareem Abu-Najm was apprehended on his bike at night in Sycamore Park in Davis and killed. Najm was a Davis High graduate who'd come from Lebanon. He was a computer science undergraduate, and he was set to finish school this spring in just a couple weeks. His family held a vigil for him on Friday. His father is a UC Davis professor. A few days after the attack on Najm on May 1st, 64-year-old Kimberly Guillory was stabbed through a tent she was sleeping on in the street, and she has since spoken with the press in the past couple days. She mentioned she was really scared as these attacks were happening and has had a lot of healing and now has a lot of healing ahead of her physically and emotionally. As for your question, they don't seem to have any connection. Davis Police Chief Darren Pytel has said they don't seem to have been targeted for who they were.
So two people were killed. A third is still recovering. The suspect was officially arrested on Thursday, charged on Friday. What can you tell us about him?
Carlos Reales Dominguez was a third-year student at UC Davis until a few days before the attacks started. The UC says it separated from him for academic reasons a few days before those attacks. It's not clear exactly what that means, but he was effectively ended his enrollment there. Multiple news outlets have confirmed he graduated from Castlemont High School in East Oakland in 2020, played on the football team there, and there are videos of him on the football team's Instagram talking about how much it means to him to be on the team. When I saw him during the live stream of the arraignment on Friday, he looked much different. His face was, his hair was much longer, face very pale. He was wearing a green Velcroed suicide vest to prevent him from hurting himself. He pled not guilty to the crimes. He seemed lucid during his time in court, responding affirmatively to the judge. ABC 10 reported over the weekend that Dominguez has been placed on an ICE detainer, which means that if he is released from custody, he could be turned over to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, as he came over to the U.S. from El Salvador as an unaccompanied minor in 2009.
So about 14 years ago. Okay, so what led police to connect the 21-year-old to these stabbings?
This was really a case where law enforcement leaned on its citizens to keep watch and let them know what they saw. The Davis Police Department received hundreds of tips. Ultimately, they received a tip that led police straight to him. He was very close to Sycamore Park, where he'd attacked Najm. No motive has been named. I mean, effectively, the city hunkered down as these attacks were taking place, and the police collaborated with forces all over the area to increase patrol and make sure they had those extra resources.
Yeah. I mean, for those unfamiliar with this college town, just help us visualize the community and the culture of Davis.
Davis is known to be a really safe bubble, right? There's lots of students, families. People feel safe walking and biking around at all hours. And this period of time has inspired a lot of fear and panic for all people, and especially for people who, had to be out on the streets, who were living on the streets. And there's a sense that if it could happen in Davis, of all places, it could happen anywhere. So there's a lot of healing ahead for this community.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that the third victim, the one who survived and is recovering, was experiencing homelessness. They slept in a tent when that attack happened.
Right. And there are accounts of folks who were sleeping on tents, moving their tents and making sure that they perhaps could get into shelter and making sure that they could be safe. But ultimately, Kimberly Guillory was a victim.
Yeah. In addition, I mean, there was not only unhoused people who were impacted, but a student as well. So what happens next in all of this?
So for Dominguez, there's a scheduled preliminary hearing on May 22nd. So this has been moving really, really quickly. The speed will now slow down a bit, and we'll know more in a couple of weeks then. For Davis, there's a lot of healing and processing that's ahead. A lot, I think, is going to have to happen to make people feel safe again. I think people will be watching this trial very closely. In the meantime, there's also a GoFundMe to help Kimberly Guillory and a scholarship that Najm's family has set up to help other undergraduates conduct research. Najm was a really passionate undergraduate researcher who was really hoping to make an impact with technology. And so they really want to elevate the experiences and bring his spirit to the efforts of others.
Kate, thank you for the update.
Thanks, Vicki.
That is CAP Radio reporter Kate Wolf updating us about the arrest of a former UC Davis student facing two counts of murder and one count of attempted murder in connection to three stabbings attacks that killed two people in the city of Davis. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Involuntary servitude, also known as forced labor, is largely banned in California, with one exception, as punishment for a crime. Across the country, states are reevaluating whether involuntary servitude has a place in prisons, and that includes California. We currently are among a minority of 16 states that allows for this exception. A bill wants to let voters decide whether to change the language in the state constitution to, quote, prohibit slavery in any form, including forced labor, by the use of threat or threat of physical or legal coercion. While incarcerated, inmates are generally paid from 8 cents to 37 cents an hour. That ranges from $12 to $56 a month for work that includes making furniture for state offices, license plates, debris cleanup, and also fighting wildfires along other fire agencies. The prison population is also disproportionately people of color. African Americans make up just 6% of California's overall population, but in prisons, they make up 28%. That's more than four times that percentage. We're going to speak with the author of the bill in just a moment. But first, we're starting with Dorsey Nunn, who heads the organizations All of Us Are None and Legal Services for Prisoners with Children, using his own experience as someone formerly incarcerated to advocate for prison reform. Dorsey, thank you for making the time.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to make the time. You know, I've been in the struggle for, you know, a number of years.
You devoted more than 40 years to criminal justice reform, for more than 40 years and counting. But prior to that, you have personal and lived experience with the criminal justice system. You were sentenced to life at 19 years old. You completed parole in 1984. How did that time shape your understanding of the justice system?
One of the things that initially stood out, I could still remember walking in, and I know their prison has a color. What I seen was a large concentration of black and brown people. And when I started running across people that I grew up with, I was asking the question that how did we all wind up in this situation? So it's like when I was incarcerated initially, when I was angry, it was like, you know, cussing them out a whole bunch. my daughter my start growing up, if there was any behavior modification going on, it was her modifying my behavior. Because probably from a real young age, she was asking me, Daddy, why are you going to be home when I get married? You know, Daddy, I want to do this. Daddy, I want to do that. And, you know, so I started feeding into that in a real particular way. Another thing that stood out was I didn't want to be a burden on my family. And I was trying to actually figure out how did I navigate that space, because I come from a poor background. The reality of it is that when I was in prison, the thing that stands out was that the most money I ever made on any employment situation inside of the institution was $31 or $32 a month, which didn't necessarily mean that it ever gave me the ability to save any resources to actually navigate space when I was released from prison. So the last year of my time in prison, I felt desperate. I knew that I was going to get out of prison. I knew that I was no longer a 19-year-old kid. I was a 31-year-old man. The maximum amount of money that I had been able to wrap my head around was probably $500 or $600 in terms of the savings. And that was what was ahead of me. What they were doing was enslaving a group of people. And some of those people that they enslaved was the descendants of people from chattel slavery. Because if you looked at the numbers, which I have, it is the incarceration rate of Black men and Black women is far exceeds the incarceration rate of everybody else. You know, so it was like, you know, some of us went directly from chattel slavery to state-sponsored slavery. So I think that slavery could be made invisible. And in my situation, that my slavery was made invisible by the narrative of punishment. It wasn't just punishment in itself. It was that people were actually exploiting me in a real particular manner.
We're talking to you because there's a bill that could potentially change that, right? There's a bill that would eliminate involuntary servitude. It is known as the End Slavery in California Act, ACA 8, and that would essentially amend the state constitution to prohibit slavery in any form. Because as it stands now, involuntary servitude can take place as a punishment to a crime, and people may be learning about involuntary servitude for the first time right now. In your view, how is that equal to slavery?
How is that equal to slavery? I'm one of the people that in California for periods of time that could be sold on the stock exchange. When we was actually practicing that stuff with private prisons, and they had embedded in their contract capacity levels that had to be met on the report of in the contract. And people would pay for the privilege of actually locking me up. They would be paying, I think, the Correctional Corporation of America. You know, it was trading upon bodies. Amendment 1, Section 6 in the state of California has embedded in it the ability to actually practice involuntary servitude. And involuntary servitude is slavery. You know, so we like to, you know, use wording that actually confuse people, that as taxpayers, we're probably all guilty of enslaving people. Everybody thinks just because you've been convicted of a crime that you could be enslaved. You know, the question I'm going to ask California, see if they can actually answer this question. In a country that was built on the backs of slaves, should slavery be permissible under any circumstances? I've been at this work for 50 years, you know, and in fact, Governor Newsom's just talked about renaming San Quentin to San Quentin Rehabilitation Center. And one of the things that Governor Newsom said was that it failed. The venture in terms of punishing people to do something radically different failed. So I'm not just saying you failed. Other people are saying you failed. At a certain point, you need to really consider what do we do as society overall? Because one of the things that he talked about during his presentation was the vast number of people going to prison are going to come home. What are they going to come home to? And how do you want them to exit prison to come home? I can absolutely tell you the first year that I was out, I was angry as hell until I met people that actually showed me compassion and love. And I learned how to love people in a far more different way. And in reality, I think that the rehabilitation I experienced it a year after I got out. Not the 10 years or 11 years that I was in. And it froze me from being able to move. I have had no other job basically, since I've been home, other than fighting for the full restoration of civil and human rights of incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people. And if you notice, I said formerly incarcerated people. The emphasis is people. I don't want to be judged based on the worst day of my life and expect that I'm going to actually be integrated in a real way. So, like, you know, what did I learn? Amendment 1, Section 6 in the California Constitution is a knockoff version of what's in the 13th Amendment federally. What I'm fighting for is to actually get it removed out of the Constitution in California, because ultimately we should remove it out of the federal constitution, period, too. You know, so if we're going to be have built a nation on the backs of chattel slaves, should we think that we have a higher moral ground to actually still participate in that and make it invisible through language? I hope I answered your question.
You certainly did.
Sometimes I get excited. At this point, I'm 71 years old, and I don't want my great-grandkids to enter into society where we think that slavery is something that we should practice. Because I don't only think that it devalues Black and brown people, it devalues human beings, period. So like when he passed me by and we out there on the side of the freeway, fighting the forest fires, making the license plates, making the detergents that scrub the tunnels that you drive the cars through, doing all these other things, making furniture for every state office in the state of California for pennies. Do people see that they're doing an injustice of any kind, that their participation in it is an injustice? Do they know that they elected officials that they elected? How did they vote on the issue of continuing slavery? Do they even know? You know, we wasn't asking them to make a decision. We was asking them to lead a decision before the general public. ACA 8 is asking that same question. As a society, should we weigh in and have a debate whether or not, as a state, should we practice slavery in the state of California? You know, and let's not hide it behind like sexy terms, like involuntary servitude. Let's call it what it really is, slavery is slavery.
Dorsey Nunn heads the organizations All of Us Are None and Legal Services for Prisoners with Children, using his own experience as someone formerly incarcerated to advocate for prison reform. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we're going to continue this conversation about involuntary servitude in California prisons with State Assemblymember Lori Wilson, a Democrat who introduced a bill that would let voters make the decision about whether to end forced labor while incarcerated. Assemblymember Wilson, thank you for making the time.
Thank you.
So we spoke with Dorsey Nunn, and he is with the organizations Prisoners with Children and All of Us Are None. He was also incarcerated decades ago, and he turned that experience into activism in criminal justice. When I spoke with him about this bill, he said that involuntary servitude in prisons is slavery, period. Would you agree with that statement?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is a modern form, and it's not the typical form when you think of what your mind's idea of slavery is. When you think about the movies that you've watched that depict slavery, it's not that, but it is, a modern form of slavery. And so I think it's important when we're talking about ACA 8 to really define what involuntary servitude is, because slavery is prohibited. And then it gives this exception for involuntary servitude. It says involuntary servitude is prohibitive except in these particular situations. And so I think that's why the definition of involuntary servitude and understanding that that really is a modern form of slavery is really important.
I mean, involuntary servitude can take place as a punishment for a crime as it now stands. And yes. Now you're the lawmaker that introduced this bill. How did you become aware, or what conversations led to this piece of legislation, and just even in your own personal life, maybe even before you were a state lawmaker, the conversations and education that you received surrounding involuntary servitude? Because I do think it's a learning curve for a lot of people who haven't been personally touched by the prison system or being incarcerated.
I've had members of my family be incarcerated, and they talked about the working conditions, but I really didn't have a perspective of what that meant. Until I came to the assembly. And as a member of the Black Caucus, ACA at the time, it was ACA 3, was a priority bill. And so as a new member, to the legislature and a new member of the caucus, I was learning what were our priority bills and trying to understand the background behind them. And to be honest, I wasn't really worried about AC3. It seemed like, as a new legislator, a no-brainer. So I just assumed that one was going to go pass. And so I was focused on other priorities that we had and learning more about that. And then I became really surprised when we got towards the end of session and this wasn't making it off the floor on the Senate side. And it was shocking to me because it seemed like such an easy bill. And then learned very quickly that it wasn't, and that there were a lot of conversations around the economic impact of California, a lot of conversations happening around what is punishment, what is rehabilitation, what does that mean? Because we have very strong views, I believe, certain individuals on like when people go to prisons, what rights they should have and shouldn't have, and you know, they did something really bad, or you know, so they shouldn't get this. And so I would just was surprised and caught off guard by that. So that when it didn't pass and I became chair, I was chair elect at the time, when it didn't pass, I became chair of the Black Caucus. It was really important for me that we picked up this bill again, and that we fight for it from day one, to ensure it makes it across the finish line, because it just wasn't, it was just absolutely inconsistent with our values. So my desire to be a part of this conversation really came through the fact that we were still having the conversation in 2022.
And when you talk about ACA3, I mean, that was killed last year when you say last session, and now you introduced a bill that is ACA8, and that is a similar amendment to California's constitution. When getting to that economic impact, last year, the Associated Press reported that Governor Gavin Newsom's administration, they warned that it could cost taxpayers billions of dollars by forcing the state to pay prisoners $15 per hour, that's a minimum wage, versus what they currently get paid, which is less than a dollar an hour. How do you square the financial impact, the fiscal sustainability, with the need to overhaul what you believe is a harmful practice of exploiting inmates who disproportionately are people of color?
Yes. First of all, I think that although there is an economic impact, because like I noted that California is the greatest beneficiary to this being in our constitution, right? We receive all the benefits primarily from it. And so, of course, there's going to be an economic impact in that way. But this $15 an hour minimum wage requirement, it's already been proven through court that there is not this minimum wage requirement. And so I thought it was really interesting for the governor's administration or Department of Finance to use that amount as the wage to determine the impact to the state, when there's already current precedent that those that are incarcerated can be paid less. The question is what is, you know, a working wage or a minimum wage when you're incarcerated, when a portion of your expenses are paid by something else, you know, by the state, and where you strike that balance. And the court has spoke on that. And I think there's opportunity even beyond that to legislate on that. But that was, you know, that was a bit frustrating and something we're working through right now. But also just realizing that when you think about what our moral values are, what our aspirational goals as a state are, and where we've aligned ourselves as the most progressive state in the union, we have to say that the economic loss or impact to our state cannot be worth this. Just like that calculus was made when we talked about slavery as a country a long time ago, it was determined that although there was going to be an economic impact, it was not worth it, the value of a human life. The value of the human life was much greater. And so I think we need to be at that position in the state, that we as legislators, because we're the ones who involved in this decision, both the Assembly and the Senate side, to bring this to the voters, that we as legislators say the value of a human life, the value of rehabilitation, the value of giving people a second chance is way more important than an economic impact. And we really need to define what that economic impact is, and as well as give this to the voters so the voters can decide this as well and agree with us. It's not about the administration at this point, although I give all deference and respect to our governor and appreciate the collaborative relationship we have, not only as he with the legislature, but he with the California Legislative Black Caucus. But when it comes to this particular issue, it's about the legislature saying human life is more important than slavery, even a modern form. And it's giving it to the voters the opportunity to agree with us and say that as well, the voters of California.
You mentioned that California is a beneficiary of this labor. What benefits do Californians receive from the goods and the labor of incarcerated individuals?
I think when you look at even materials that are given that State Department and agencies use, whether it's furniture, or if you think about our license plates, our, you know, there's so many ways we use prison labor.
Even wildfires as well.
Absolutely. That's a huge one, is Cal Fire, and that support that we get from incarcerated individuals. And these individuals are putting their life on the line for us to keep us safe. And those same individuals, one, they're being paid very low wages to do that work. And they're being, and when they leave, they can't even do that work. They're not allowed to do that work because many of the barriers and challenges that are put in at the individual fire departments that prevent them from being able to, even though they're fully trained to be able to then do that work once they're out of prison. And if for whatever reason they don't do the work that they're supposed to do, there's so many consequences to that, which brings in the involuntary servitude part. There's consequences like, you know, and being in solitary confinement, being on C status, not getting family visits, taking away good credits. You know, and that's what makes it involuntary servitude, is that punishment part that forces it to be, you know, aligned with slavery more than just, you know, rehabilitative work.
A concern by critics is that the amendment doesn't take into consideration or prioritize victims or the families of victims who feel imprisonment and forced labor for incarcerated individuals is fair. What is your response to that?
I would say that when we put someone in our prison system, we are saying it is rehabilitative in nature. That is a part of, even if you think about the title of our correction system, it ends with an R, rehabilitation, right? And so I understand victims of crime. You know, my family has been the victim of crime. But I also know that there is room for rehabilitation when there's trauma, and then you keep compounding trauma on top of trauma, no one gets better. Because remember, that individual has a whole family that care and love for them as well. And so when that individual is paying for that mistake or that crime, we want to limit the impact that it is to the innocent people in that person's family, the trauma there, because if not, then that trauma will beget more trauma. And so, and that's why it's so important that we have a system that's rehabilitative. And then also recognize that our criminal justice system is not perfect, and that there are so many people in prison, including a disproportionate number of Black and brown people, who have not committed the crimes that they've been convicted of. And so we have to recognize we have a faulty system, but it is the best system that we have. And the aspirational goals of that system are good, but we do have to focus our system on rehabilitation, and slavery cannot be a part of that, nor a modern form of slavery, but involuntary servitude.
I was reading an LA Times article that wrote that other opponents of the amendment, they say that eliminating work requirements could weaken rehabilitation. And I think about a conversation I had recently this year, and it involved Rio Casumnas Correctional Center that trains female inmates in the coffee industry, offering them a pipeline to a career once they complete their sentence. The woman I spoke with completed her sentence on a Friday, had a job lined up that Monday. And that is just one example. I mean, there's equine therapy, welding, culinary training, and et cetera.
Right. I think for me, when I look at the work requirements, it should tie to rehabilitation and it should not tie to punishment. And I think that's where the difference is for me. Most prisoners, most incarcerated individuals want to work. They want to be productive. Serving time is a difficult and challenging task. And the opportunity to do something helps alleviate some of those challenges and difficulties, as well as provide resources for them while they're there, because there are expenses while in prison, not only for the person serving, as well as outside of service to their family, you know, household. And so most of them want to work. And I've found that as I've had conversations with individuals who were incarcerated and previously incarcerated. So I don't think that will be a necessary issue, but I do think there has to be a conversation in the legislature about defining what is a work requirement in a rehabilitative environment, and making that very clear. And that's part of my discussions as a separate. I think that the Constitution, what we put in the Constitution, has to be very pure and direct to the voters. But what we do legislatively outside of that, and definition of what is a work requirement and it tying to rehabilitation versus punishment, is the direction we need to head in. And that's where I see the distinction on that.
Given that this is the second go around, you know, 2 years in a row, how is ACA 8, the bill that you authored and introduced, different from the previous bill from last session?
Right now, it is the exact same language. We are having conversations with both the Senate side and including the governor's administration to ensure there's not unintended consequences. We saw that with other states that's passed similar legislation. We're going to try this again because this opens up for other things. And so we're having those conversations to make sure what we vote on at the legislature level is the same from on the assembly floor as it will be on the Senate floor. So we get it to the voters and then work through definitions and creating legislation that defines that language to ensure that this is not something that's fought out in the court system, but really we as a legislative body and part of our government don't punt it to our judicial system, that we really do work through and do the job that we were sent here to do, which is legislate and create laws. So I think that that's where you'll see the differences, is that you'll see some tweaks of definitions that are pure and clean that we believe the voters can vote on, as well as potential legislation that further defines what we're looking to do to ensure that any work related to for our incarcerated individuals is rehabilitative work and part of their rehabilitative plan and not part of their punishment or part of cheap labor to benefit California or anyone else.
I understand legislatively you're in the thick of it and it's going through negotiations, it's going back and forth, potential amendments as well. But just generally speaking, how will the life of someone incarcerated be different if this crosses the finish line and voters approve it?
It means that, one, they will receive more wages than they currently do. Some receive 8 cents an hour, 35 cents an hour. Like you noted, most it's less than a dollar. So additional wages will be given. Two, when they earn credits, just like we earn leave when we work, if we choose to not show up or leave that job, those aren't taken away from us. So if someone earns credits, those are not taken away by refusing to work or just being sick. Like, you know, if we call in sick, we get the benefit of the doubt. We're sick. Because if it's over 3 days, you got to get a doctor's note. There's this process. Well, if someone is not feeling well that day, it really is up to the correctional officers overseeing them to determine whether they're really sick or not sick. And there's a whole process to it. And if it's determined they weren't, then there's punishment associated with it. So there's this whole other thing. So you can't just be not feeling well. Like I said, you can lose credits that you've earned. You can lose spending time with your family, which, you know, is very much rehabilitative. You can lose access to calling someone. And so I think that, you know, that's how it will feel different, is they'll have greater ownership of their own personhood and their rehabilitative plan, so that hopefully when they're out of prison, that recidivism rate is reduced and that person is able to live a whole and healthy life outside of prison if they're not one that is chosen to, you know, spend the rest of their days. But then if they are one that is supposed to spend the rest of their days, then at least they'll have a sense of ownership of their own life, of their own personhood. And that's what we want for people so that they can be a better person and engage with their family in better ways and with other inmates, which will make it safer for even our correctional officers.
You mentioned that other states have already voted to abolish slavery and involuntary servitude in their prison systems. And I'm just curious, because California officials, often Democrats, call our state a leader. I mean, I believe you called her progressive, right? A progressive leader or a nation state in the governor's own words. So what has taken so long to ban imposing labor on inmates?
It is interesting. We are only one of 16. And I believe after this legislative cycle, if we do not approve it, we'll be one of four left, which is a weird place to be. Because California is typically the leader on these issues. And I think part of it is the economic impact, that has people concerned. And my thing is, you can be concerned about that. My background is finance and accounting. I am always concerned about dollars and cents. But the way you do that is you don't put your hand in the sand and say, I'm not going to, direct this issue, you mitigate it. right? And so that's what I'm used to doing. And in my background doing budget administration, we start working through, well, what are the problems here? How do we mitigate that? And so I think that that's something that we have to be able to do in this legislation and bring it forth, because we can't be the last. That's just not our way. It's not our way in California. We were always out front. We're always bold with what we do. And so I want us to be just as bold in this space, especially because we'll be one of four, which is crazy that 50 states in the union have either, because some of them never had it in there. They had always had it abolished, like I said. And then there was a group that got it done, and now there are 16 left. And if we don't do it, we will be part of the last four. And that will be sad. That will be a sad day.
There are larger conversations that are taking place, not only conversations, action. I mean, this bill also comes as California has its first reparation task force for Californians, yes, who are descendants of slavery, and that is currently in the process as we're talking. Okay. So how does this broader conversation and shift about accountability shape the response and possibly the weight of support behind this bill?
I think, we've engaged members of the public over the last, remember, because this is now like we're in the third year of direct conversation in California. There's been lots of groundwork laid by the organizations and the activists on the subject even prior to that. But there's been almost three years of active conversation in the legislature on this. And I've seen a shift in the minds of people. I think the sticker shock got them at first. But now people are realizing, wait, hold on. Because I think people were surprised like I was. I think people had concerns, but they didn't think it wasn't going to pass, right? And then now we're in this place where it didn't. And so now people are like, okay, let's be serious about this, because they are used to being in the leadership position. And it is much harder to be in the follower position, especially on an issue as great as this, especially on the issue that hits to our core values of equity. And so I think this is a part of it because of the disproportionate impact on Black and brown people, people of color in our prison system.
Finally, if ACA 8 were passed, it clears the hurdles at the state legislature. What are the next steps?
So the voters. The next step is the voters.
So it would be in 2024.
Yes.
Voters would decide.
The voters would decide. It'll be one of the constitutional amendments. And the voters will have an opportunity to vote up or down on it. And I believe Californians will vote their values, and that we will finally see this language stricken, any exception to slavery stricken from our Constitution.
Assemblymember Wilson, it was a pleasure.
Thank you so much for the time.
That is State Assemblymember Lori Wilson. The Democrat introduced a bill that would let voters make the decision about whether to end involuntary servitude or forced labor while incarcerated. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The Rosemont High School robotics team has a lot to celebrate this year. They just returned from the World Robotics Championship in Houston. The student engineers built a robot capable of taking on more than 600 teams across the world. I sat down with Dave Stafford, the head mentor for the Wolverine robotics team, along with Rosemont High seniors Diana Torres Arias and Mitchell Millibar, about the international exposure. First of all, welcome all of you to Insight. This is a good bunch we have here.
Thanks for having us.
Dave, I want to start with you and just kind of learning about the robotics team at Rosemont High and how it got its start.
So at the time, I was a relatively new teacher at Rosemont High School, and the principal and another one of our teachers there wanted to get the team going again. They had had one several years before. And then ultimately, right mid-December, they said, no, you really are going to do this. So I coerced my AP physics class into being my first team. And we struggled mightily that first year. And like I said, once we showed up at the first competition, everything changed for all of us. Because it is quite an experience if you've never ever been to one.
And if I understand it correctly, are you now retired, but you still go back to mentor?
Yes, that's true. I retired just short of a year ago, but my intent was always to stay with FIRST Robotics, whether it's with this team, Team 5274 at Rosemont, which I hope it is, or more on more of a national basis.
What keeps you coming back to it?
The students, for sure. They drive everything. It's such a thrill to watch them learn and grow, and they're fun to be around. And we laugh all the time. There's nothing like a lot of smiles and laughter to just keep you motivated to do this stuff.
All right. Well, that brings me to the students, Diana and Mitchell. What do you do for the robotics team? Diana, I'll start with you.
I'm the business team lead on our school's robotics team.
Great. How about you, Mitchell?
So I am head driver and co-head builder for this past year's team.
All right. So for someone who isn't into robotics like myself, what exactly does that mean?
So during the competition, we do actually drive our robots on the field. So that is my position. I am one of the two drivers or co-head builder. And we kind of formulate the plan on what we will actually be building for this year's robotic competition.
Why do you love it?
I love it because I'm really into STEM. I've been really into STEM. It's a good way to kind of just do something with your hands. It's a really fun way to learn.
Nice. And how does it feel to compete, though? Not only just create stuff, but actually go up against other schools?
Competing is a whole new level. The room always gets really, really energetic whenever a match is about to start. And it's similar towards like an adrenaline rush. It's a really fulfilling experience.
Would you agree, Dave?
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's nothing like when the crowd is yelling. I mean, that's the basis for FIRST Robotics. The Dean Kamen, who's the originator of it, he always wanted to put together a program that highlighted kids in STEM on a highly competitive field that was reminiscent of wrapping the Super Bowl, the World Series, and the NBA Finals all together in one place.
All right, Diana, well, that brings me to you. Why do you love doing it?
The community. I really like the community. It's so wholesome and interconnected, and it always makes you feel like you belong there.
What grade are both of you in?
I'm a senior.
I'm also a senior.
And how long have the both of you been doing it?
We both started in seventh grade.
Are you really grateful that you've had it for 6 years, given that both of you have stuck with it for several years?
Oh, absolutely.
Extremely grateful.
Yeah. For people who may be thinking about maybe getting their children into it, or maybe they're thinking about getting into it themselves, what did it add to your academic experience and your school experience?
It definitely transferred over into my schooling career and basic day-to-day basis. I didn't realize how much all of the things I was learning at competitions was actually helping me make friends or get more into my school subjects and whatnot.
Robotics for me, this has been the most amount of time I've had to do any public speaking, so that's really helped in classes and such where you have to give presentations. Robotics has also taught me a lot about how to manage your time, because we do have a lot of time constraints in the competition, so.
Yeah. Dave, I would imagine since you have the hindsight of almost a decade of robotics teams at a high school level, that there are so many lessons that students gain and can apply to their lives even outside of robotics or STEM.
Oh, absolutely. And we see it all the time. We've got a number of students now that are, finished high school, finished college. They're in the tech sector. We have students that are at Caltech. We have students that are at Davis, and students at Northwestern. Both of these students are going into the STEM fields, one at UC San Diego, one here at Sac State. We bring those folks back because they love coming back from time to time, too, and they can share their experiences. And it just helps to, make education more real, ultimately, because we know, take history classes, you take science classes, you take English classes, but this kind of helps wrap all those things together.
When it comes to the World Championship in Houston, how was the experience for you, Mitchell?
It was really, really eye-opening. I mean, being part of the team, I always heard the stories of the last time they went to the competition and how awe-inspiring it was. And then to actually be there and driving and participating, it was a surreal experience.
Diana, can you help us visualize what the competition was like, what you actually had to put in to compete against other teams?
It was very daunting at first. You would walk in and you would see everyone was super at work and super focused on everything that they were doing. And you would sit there and you'd wonder, what am I doing here?
Is it basically you're creating a robot to go through an obstacle course, or how does it work?
I like to compare it to like a game, like a basketball game. We're creating a robot to complete a set of tasks to score points to then hopefully win. But that's the general gist.
All right, Dave. So how did they do?
Oh, they did great. And to kind of just further on what Mitchell was saying, it's always 3-on-3. And one of the things I love about FIRST Robotics is they give us a different game every year. So while I completely dig football, baseball, basketball, those rules don't change much, whereas our rules change every single year. So yeah, the robot itself and our team did fabulously throughout the year.
How many teams competed in the World Championships?
620.
What were the rankings? How did you all fare?
Well, so...
Or is it a more complicated answer than the simple question?
Yeah, it is. It's a complicated answer. There's 8 divisions, so they broke us up into 8, like 8 smaller, like as if we were doing regionals. And there were 77 in our group. We were in the Newton division. Each one of the groups was named after a famous scientist. We ended up 58th in that division, but our robot ran much better than 58th. And overall, we were probably a top 50 percentile robot throughout the competition.
How did that feel for the both of you?
As the driver of the robot, I was really proud of what our robot was able to accomplish throughout the competition. I do think as a team, we performed very well. We were able to provide a lot of support for our alliances and able to keep the point scores high.
For us, I was just going to say, we were really proud to say that, yeah, that's our robot out on the field. So it really helped keep morale up in the stands.
Did the robot have a name?
Yeah, so the robot's name this year, it's Armageddon. And the reason its name is that is because the robot does have a giant arm on it.
And it's spelled ARM-A-GET-N. Armageddon.
I love that. I'm just thinking about a robotics team and the amount of cost that goes into this. How do you get this funded?
A lot of the money comes through grants that we apply for. Certainly, when you throw a wrench into the plan, like you're going to go to the World Championships, which is a $25,000 bill, you now expand what it is you're going to do to try to get those funds. So we did, a lot of families stepped up and helped us do a 99 Pledges campaign. We also took the robot to a couple of different functions where it was going to have dinner with the robot at J.J. Pfister and Sandwich Spot and a few other places that, you know, that hosted us to kind of just get it out there. And people were happy to, you know, give us $20 here and $40 there. And ultimately, the after-school program, Rosemont 21st Century Assets, stepped up and paid for our hotels and our air flight. So that helped tremendously. But we are always looking for sustainable sponsorships. And we have some, you know, renewed enthusiasm in the adults to help us and make more contacts with the local tech companies. And we have a whole list of them. So be prepared out there if you're listening. We're probably knocking on your door at some point.
Hey, every dollar counts, you know?
That's right.
Finally, Mitchell and Diana, you are rounding out high school. What does the future hold for you? What do you hope it holds?
I will be attending school here at Sac State. I like staying in Sacramento. It's nice. It's comfortable. But I really do want to get out there, kind of expand my opportunities and further my career in STEM.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's good to get out of a bubble. I felt that way when I went away to college. How about you, Diana?
I'm going to be heading down to UC San Diego. I really wanted to stay and mentor for our team at Rosemont, but I'm going to be 7 hours away. So hopefully I can at least stay connected with some of the students that I know through like Zoom calls and whatnot.
And I will say with Mitchell staying here, we're kind of thrilled because he has agreed to come back and do some driver coaching for us. So
Yeah, that mentorship is invaluable.
Absolutely.
It makes it so much more tangible for students.
Yeah. Well, in fact, my second in command was on our original team. He's since, you know, obviously graduated high school the year that we went to championships the first time, which was in 2016. And now he's finishing up his degree in mechanical engineering here at Sac State. And he's been, he's one of my best friends at this point. So,
well, congratulations to the both of you. And thank you so much, Dave, for corralling them and bringing them here to the Insight Studio.
Thank you so much.
Dave Stafford is the head mentor for the Wolverine Robotics team, joined by Rosemont High seniors Diana Torres Arias and Mitchell Millibar, who just returned from the World Robotics Championship in Houston. And that's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to reach out, shoot us an email at insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you right back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.